Hello and welcome to another episode of the Prop Swab Podcast. I am your host, Ian Epstein, and I am also a co-founder of PropSwap, the first marketplace to buy and sell sports bets. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We've got another great episode for you. As you may notice, I am flying solo on today's episode. Luke could not be with us, but not to worry. I've got an interview with Dave Sharapan coming up. He is a Las Vegas sports betting industry veteran. I met Dave a little over 10 years ago when we both worked at Cantor Gaming, which we get into a little bit in the interview. We talk about how we got into the business, the pipeline of people from Pittsburgh that turned into bookmakers, how he became a risk manager, and then an incredible story that does involve a health scare. But not to worry, he made out of it. But an incredible story about how he transitioned from being behind the book into the sports media. It was truly a great interview, and I hope to have him back again soon so we can talk about a bunch more stuff about the industry. So sit back, relax, and please enjoy my interview with Dave Sharapan. We are here with the man himself, Dave Sharapan, sportsbook veteran and co-host of Bostonian versus the Book. Dave, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to see you, E. It's been a while. You know, back in the day, you know, we saw each other a lot in passing, and then you went and started this company and got out of the book business. Probably not a bad move at the time. A lot's changed since, but yeah, it's good to see you, man.
Yeah. I want to get into that. You know, we've known each other for quite a bit, but yeah, it was kind of a lot in passing. But before we get into that, I just kind of wanted to talk about how you yourself got into the sports betting industry, and you're from Pittsburgh originally. So kind of what was the decision-making process of coming out to Las Vegas and getting into the industry?
Incredible, wild journey. Basically started growing up in Pittsburgh, going to Penn State for school, coming home, graduated with a broadcast journalism degree, and had to work three jobs and a bunch of different things. And a guy says to me at the time, and I had been around the business, like with guys answering phones and, you know, barbershops and different bars and different things like that. So knew a lot of people and did a lot of things. Guy says to me, do you know anybody, would you be interested in moving to the Caribbean and helping run an offshore sports book? This was in the late 90s. And I was working three jobs, like I said. I hated winter. I always wanted to live where there was palm trees. So I said, yes. I said, I'll take a shot. Went down 97, 98, down in Curacao, did a little stint in the Dominican Republic, learned the business from the ground up, essentially got a PhD in it, and worked every day, basically, for almost 2 years. It was a long, long, long 18 months, 20 months, and came back to Pittsburgh in February after the Super Bowl when Elway did the helicopter, and it was 9 degrees. And I was like, I got to get out of here. So bided my time, did some things, worked for a handicapping service, learned, you know, stayed in the business, but moved out to Arizona first and ended up in Vegas 5 years later. So I was in Scottsdale until about 2003, and then in Vegas 2003 as a stay-at-home dad. And I'm playing hockey. I go meet some people, and a guy says, you know the book business pretty good. They'll hire you to be a writer. And I needed to get out of the house and find something to do to stop changing diapers. So I went and wrote tickets at the Golden Nugget, $9.50 an hour, part-time. 2 days a week, basically two nights a week. They couldn't find anybody to close the book. So I started on a Friday night, the Saturday night close. The stuff I saw, Ian, I can't even begin to tell you. I cannot begin to tell you.
I'm sure. I guess I'm kind of jumping around here, but so you got a major in broadcast journalism. I'm sure you were a huge sports fan. I don't think you can probably grow up in Pittsburgh and not be a huge sports fan. was it just kind of like the opportunity that was presented to you that kind of made you go down the sports betting path versus the sports media path, which obviously you found yourself in, you know, later in life? But, you know, how, you know, what, you know, was there a dream there in kind of sports broadcast journalism that kind of you pressed the pause button on there?
Oh, 100%. I was going to be on SportsCenter. That was, I mean, a kid growing up in Pittsburgh around sports. Jack Ham was my next door neighbor. I was around it all the time. I was playing sports. I started playing hockey when I was 4, and I played with the Pittsburgh Penguins kids. We lived really close to the city. I played baseball with some of the Pirates kids and was at games all the time. My dad and my uncle were really good athletes. They tried out for the Pirates in 1961, and we all played sports. So around sports all the time, and realized when I got to college and I was playing, you know, Penn State was a club sport, hockey, I wasn't going to be able to play sports, and I got into the broadcast part of it. It's a hard gig. I mean, they don't tell you why you're in college getting that degree. That you're going to graduate. You're going to have to work. I interned for 3 summers at KDK and TV in Pittsburgh, cutting baseball highlights, going to Penguin practices, going to training camp. I got to put a wireless mic on Arnold Palmer and walk 9 holes with him and then edit highlights. I said yes to everything. I covered anything that they said to do, I did, because 1, I loved it. It never felt like work. But 2, it was just get experience. Just do it and you'll figure it out later. The opportunity came to go to Curacao. It was a complete pivot. You never know when these things are going to come up. Try telling your mother, 100% Italian, I'm the oldest of 5, first one to graduate college, that you're moving to the Caribbean to go work at a bookie joint. She wasn't going to have it. I mean, but my dad said to go, so I did. And I knew the guy I was going to work for. The rest is history. I learned that business. I got my PhD. Instead of going to law school or getting an MBA, I went and got a PhD in the business. Haven't looked back since.
Yeah. I kind of felt that way about working at Cantor Gaming, which is where we work together, and which I want to get to that in a second. But from my experience and talking to people and reading books, there seems to be this pipeline of guys from Pittsburgh that make it out to Vegas and become, you know, a world renowned bookmaker. And so, you know, before we started this interview, I thought, you know, you were just kind of part of that pipeline almost, but obviously I didn't realize you took the kind of circuitous route, to offshore. But explain why, you know, I mean, there's Jimmy Vaccaro, Chris Andrews, Art Manteras, just to name a few. You know, what is it about Pittsburgh that forms these types of odds makers?
The irony in all of it is, right, I show up at the Golden Nugget at the behest of a guy I was playing hockey with. And I walk in and do the interview with Chris Andrews. And we start talking. We know all the same people. Like, he goes, wait, you know so-and-so and so-and-so? And I'm like, yeah. Everybody at home knows everybody in this business. He goes, you're hired. I'll put your stuff through. It's Thursday. You start Saturday. And I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get a babysitter. He's like, do you want the job or not? You're hired. I said, I guess I'll take it. And that's how, like, the guy that I went to Curacao for, Pittsburgh guy, it's, I don't want to say it's part of the culture, but, like, we were filling out tip sheets, parlay cards, essentially, when we were 12. Like, you know, we had a kid in the neighborhood who said, hey, take these things, pick 4 winners, we'll pay you 6-1, and oh yeah, ties loose. And everything, every game was 3, 7, or 10. So it's a weird thing. And we talked about it all the time growing up. And then when I came back from Curacao, even before I moved out west, all they had to do was make it legal. There's guys doing it on the south side of Pittsburgh and the north end of Pittsburgh that are doing it just like Vegas casinos are. So it's wild to think about. I don't know exactly how it was a migration, but it's true. There's a Pittsburgh thing. There's connections all over. Jimmy was here and went back to Pittsburgh, realized he hated winter, and came back to the South Point.
Yeah.
We don't like winter, Ian. Like, after a while, it just beats it out of you. Where do you go where you can still do this business? Vegas was the only place. So a guy came, called his buddy, said, hey, they let us operate here. As long as you don't do anything too crazy, you can come too. And I think it just was one thing led to another. Guy knows a guy knows a guy. And half the people working in the books are from Pittsburgh.
Yeah. And yeah, maybe there's something there where it's like, you know, I don't know you, but you know a guy that I know, and that's good enough. Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, sports betting being legal only in Nevada was the reason I moved out there. And, you know, I spotted Cantor Gaming as this company I wanted to work for because all they did was sports betting, right? It wasn't going to work for MGM, where sports betting was one little tiny facet. So that's what appealed to me to go work for Cantor Gaming. And that's kind of where we crossed paths at the M Casino, where, you know, you were working out there. And I got a job after working in the main office, the kind of the headquarters in the marketing department. I said, hey, I really want to, you know, work in the odds room. And in a pretty short order of time, I got that job. And I don't think I've ever said this to you, but I mean, I remember going there and feeling like I was way out of my element because I never worked as a ticket writer. I never worked as a supervisor.
Yep.
You know, I never worked the front line, which, you know, kind of was part of my plan. I never wanted to have those frontline jobs, but that's usually what you got to do to work your way up. And so I remember meeting you there and thinking, this guy knows way more about booking than I do. I was like 23 years old at the time. So, you know, I never kind of said this to you, but I always thought, like, you know, a little bit of imposter syndrome where you seemed like you knew everybody, you knew what the bettors, the staff. And but yeah, I mean, you know, I just kind of wanted to talk about like your time at Cantor and
yeah, Ian, it was crazy. That was a crazy, crazy time. Like, so I go to the Nugget in 2004 and they're filming a reality show. Poster and Breitling owned the place and we took everybody. There wasn't anyone we didn't take bets from. Chris was running a shop that reminded me of being in Curacao. And I was like, this is great. And Bogdanovich was his assistant. So we had Nick and Chris, you know, two guys that have been in the business in Nevada for a long time at different places taking bets. I get the opportunity to go to the M, which was so far out of nowhere. Like at the time, I remember taking a ride out there and going, I can't drive out here. Hey, there's no way. And then as it started to get built and they started to build the crew, I'm like, this might be the move. I walked in there before they were open and saw that high ceiling with those two big screens. And I was like, this is it. I'm doing it. I'm coming. So I go out and you were there. We were doing it again. We were taking everybody from everything. And I was like, this is too good. This can't be. So opportunities allowed different people to come in. We saw a lot of people come and go. It's a hard job. People keep thinking that the risk room is like exciting. That's the hardest non-thankful job you could possibly have in a book. Because when you win, they don't even say thank you. But if you lose or you get bad breaks, you know, everybody bets one side. It doesn't matter what you make the line or move it to. There's all these questions, meetings, all this other stuff. If the top down doesn't understand the business, you're drawn dead. And that's where it's hard. So I stayed out there writing tickets for a while. And then as it started to talk about going legal other places, I got shipped down to the Strip. So I did more operation stuff, always taking bets, but like supervisor job, the admin job I skipped because it usually goes ticket writer, admin, supervisor, and then you have to decide, am I going risk oriented or operations and marketing oriented? That's the path for most people in this business. we got a big curveball in life in this business. Went past my past. It was like, wait, we can do this other places? And that's where what I thought was going to be a world of opportunity opened up.
Yeah. I always tell people about odds risk management. You know, it's like bacon. You love to eat it, but you would hate to see it made. Like it is not
100%. Oh, that's a great analogy. I love it. Yeah. It's not easy.
Yeah. And to your point, like if the people at the top don't understand that, like you can't force people to bet a certain side, like you're going to be lopsided in certain situations and you can't control the outcome of the game.
If you can figure that out right now, if anyone's watching or listening to this somewhere, that's you can change the game and you can write your own ticket in the future of this business. If you can figure out how to get someone and pull them in off the street and them willingly give you money to bet the 49ers when 80% of the people are betting the Chiefs in the Super Bowl, you figured it out. You solved the Da Vinci Code. Until then, it don't matter.
Yeah. I tell people about Cantor. First of all, I say, you know, I think they were ahead of their time, right? The mobile betting, the big bets, they were definitely ahead of their time. But there was some good lessons there about what not to do. Yes. You know, whether it be like, you know, their bottom line was determined by a handful of bettors, which is again not what you want to do. And alienated the parlay bettors by taking away like the paper parlay cards.
Yep.
They were the biggest sports book in Nevada at one point in time, and then they missed the boat when it came to PASPA being repealed. So, fast forward to 2018, PASPA gets repealed. CG was still around then, but it was not too soon after that. But I just want to go back to 2018. And what did you think the next 5 years were going to look like with sports betting becoming legalized in the U.S.? And, you know, did those kind of guesses prove to be true, or, you know, has it panned out differently than you thought in 2018?
So the talk of it passing was like, they're never going to allow this. They wouldn't even let us put the word Super Bowl on the sheets. Like, there's no way the leagues are going to say yes to this. There's no way the lawmakers are going to fool everybody into saying this is good. Completely wrong. 2018 comes. I had gone from the M to the Cosmo. Now I'm shipped over to the Venetian against my will. The Cosmo was some of the most fun couple years I ever had working in the business. It was incredible scenery, incredible action. It was great. I'm at the Venetian and I'm like, I can't take it. I don't like the book. I don't like the clientele. It's different. I get an opportunity. I get multiple opportunities, offers to go to this state or talk about this state. So I'm like, all right, I got three little kids, not little at the time. I mean, like two teenagers and a little kid. And I'm originally from Pittsburgh. So is my wife. We've raised the kids in Vegas. Do I take a shot? I get the opportunity to go be the director of a book in Wheeling, West Virginia. Now, Wheeling, West Virginia is 45 minutes from Pittsburgh. It's prodigal son returning home. There's a deal with the Steelers to do content. I'm going to go on the shows and do all this stuff. And I'm like, this is going to be great. I think I should take this opportunity. And I get a massive jump in, you know, I go right to the C-level suite job, director of sportsbook.
Sure.
At a casino. Delaware North owns it. We got a big company backing it. This is going to be great. And I say yes. I leave my wife and daughters in Vegas. I land. We go to the first day of meetings. I call my wife. God's honest truth. I said, nothing's going to work. She goes, what do you mean? I said, nothing is going to work. This is all not going to work. And she said, well, you have to stay. You took the job. I lasted 8 weeks. 8 weeks. The meetings were getting worse. I knew the software wasn't going to work. They couldn't type parlays. I said, do you understand the business? We need to be able to, no one's doing straight bets only. We need to be able to type parlays. And I came back. And when I came back, CG said, you're hired, but you have to do the risk room again. You have to do what you did offshore. We're not letting you work in a book because we need you back here.
Mm-hmm.
So I said yes, took the gig, started making the numbers again, started moving the, you know, taking the bets. Then in-game became super prevalent. And they asked us, they, you know, they had a meeting, so we're going to open up the in-game betting. Who wants to do it? You ever see them movies like where everybody's standing on the line and they say, volunteer, step forward, and everybody steps back? Well, that's what happened in the room, at the room at the M where you worked as well.
Yeah.
Everybody dove under their desks. And I was the only one sitting in the chair. I said, I'll do it. So I exclusively did everything else that I was doing, 55 to 60 hours a week. Booking every game that we did in-game, I did by myself.
Wow.
And again, you want to talk about ramp-up speed? Learned it quick. Saw all the different software. They brought in all these people. I tested the software before we used it. Some great guys brought in some great products. And we did that until COVID. COVID changed everything after that.
Gotcha. So COVID is kind of when you transitioned from, you know, working in the sports book to the more of the media side.
COVID happens this week, actually, 4 years ago. Right.
Yeah.
It was March 17th or March 18th. I can't remember the specific day where they canceled the game between Creighton and St. John's in Madison Square Garden, Big East tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Take everything off the board. We're all looking at each other like, what are we going to do? If there's no betting, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
They come in that Saturday and say, you're all fired. All of you are gone. Go home, file for unemployment. We don't need you. And I remember calling my wife on the way home. I said, I think I just got let go or laid off or fired. But they said I got to file for unemployment. Next thing you know, we're homeschooling kids because they're not going to school. Thank goodness my wife's still working. It took me about 8 weeks to get unemployment. And I'm getting nervous trying to figure it out. Then sports comes back in a bubble, and they call back one guy, me, because I could do the job of three or four people. I said, okay. So we had a morning guy, a middle shift, and a night guy. That's it. Three people ran all seven properties for CG. They didn't bring anyone else back. So working a lot, doing a lot, but this whole time I was in the risk room from 2018 on, I'm doing interviews. I'm that guy in the book everybody's talking to. So I'm building up the rapport with a lot of people and getting involved in social media. September 1st comes. We get sold to Caesars. I got the job. I'm going to go. And then something told me, just wait. Interview around, maybe make a move, whatever. September 11, 2020, in between jobs. Nothing set in stone yet. I wake up and can't talk. I say goodbye to my wife. She leaves for work and nothing comes out of my mouth. I was like, well, that was weird. I don't know why I can't talk. My five-year-old's at the table getting ready for kindergarten online. The two older ones are sleeping upstairs and I can't plug my phone into my charger. Nothing. My coordination's off and I can't talk. Like, what the hell's going on right now? I go to dial the phone and I can't. My wife's one-touch button not working. I can't figure it out. Next thing I know, I walk out to the stoop outside the door, and get her on the phone somehow. She answers the phone. She's been gone 12 minutes. She's like, what do you want? Ian, I don't know what I said, but she hung up the phone with me and called my oldest daughter and said, go check on your father. My kids are home from COVID. She comes downstairs and says, the first thing she says to me, what's wrong with you, you jagoff? Just like that. And I'm like, And this look come over her face. I'm like, what's that look for? She tells her little sister, go up in her room, shut the door. The baby, you know, five-year-old kindergarten says, what do you mean? So go play Fortnite. School's canceled for you today. Daddy, lay down. I'll be right back. She goes and gets her sister, comes down, calls her mother. My wife's on the phone. I don't know what's going on. I'm not in any pain, but I cannot talk. And I'm getting frustrated more and more and more. I'm like, this is messed up. Why can't I talk? Call 911. They're there quick. Four guys walk in. And my daughters were like angels, keeping me calm. Just daddy breathe, daddy breathe. Guy walks in and says, what's your name? Ian, for $1 million, I couldn't say Dave. He says, smile. I can't smile. He said, stick your tongue out. I can't stick my tongue out. He grabs my right arm like this and says, whose arm is this? I want to scream at this guy. It's my arm. Why are you asking me these questions? And he goes, he's having a stroke. Put him on the bus. Let's go. And I looked over both shoulders like, who's having a stroke? Me? They said, lay down, sir. Put me in a gurney. Took me out the door. First door, the ambulance closes. Second door, as it's closing, my middle daughter collapses into my oldest daughter's arms, starts crying. I'm like, oh my God, my daughters, who are going to take care of my kids? Next thing I know, we're riding to the hospital. Go to the hospital. Nobody's allowed in because of COVID. My wife's outside waiting in the parking lot. Sees me go by. What's going on? We don't know. We think he's having a stroke. I go into this room. There's 100 people over me, and 100. I'm laying. All this stuff's going on. I see a guy in my left foot, white hat, or no, white hair, white jacket, white pants, white shoes. Looks like George Washington. He's pointing at everybody. I'm like, wow, this guy's the quarterback. He's got under control. I look at my right foot, and there's a woman about 23 years old, most perfect olive skin, brunette, black scrubs, top and bottom. And I'm like, squinting. I'll never forget. I thought, this is one of the most attractive women I've ever seen. She's a smoke show. She can't be much older than my daughters. Boom, fade to black, out. While I'm out, I'm squinting to my left like this, looking at this light that I can't see. It's sunny and I can't see. I'm looking for glasses. I can't find them. Out of this light comes my dad. He's been gone 8 years, passed away in his sleep. My best friend in life. We're like this. He's the only guy that told me go to the, you know, Curacao. I'll tell your right. mother. Don't worry about it. Comes back. I can't believe it. He's like 1979. He's got a beard exactly like you. Perfect. Perfectly manicured. Hair. You know, he ended up dying in his sleep, but he had a brain tumor, became incontinent at the end. And I, you know, this dad that came back to me was perfect. He was my 9-year-old baseball coach. Hugged him. I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, sit down. We have to talk. So he sits down just like me and you. I saw the greenest grass, bluest sky, most beautiful place I've ever seen with the beach in the background. It might as well have been Mambo Beach, the beach I looked at every day while I was booking the games in Curacao. One of the pretty, Google it, Mambo Beach, Curacao. You'll see All it. Right. And you'll want to go visit. And we sat there and we talked. And mostly I listened. And he asked me about my brothers. I got two brothers, two sisters, my mom, everybody's, you know, they're doing okay, dad, you know. I said, why don't you come back with me? The little ones never met you. My kids would love to see you. My wife loves you. You know, he's like, I can't come back. I said, okay. He said, are you ready to go with me? And I said, no, I got to go back. They need me. You know that. He said, all right, we got to promise me one thing. And I said, what's that? Anything. You know, he said, stop worrying. It's like, stop worrying. Dad, I got laid off. All this business is crazy. The election, 2020 was a crazy year.
The world is feels like it was ending.
Ending, right? He said, stop worrying. I promise you everything's going to be okay. I said, wow, okay. And that was it. He stood up. He goes, all right, I got to go. And I hugged him, kissed him. We never said goodbye when we were young. It was always see you later. And I said, all right, we'll see you later. He said, I love you too. He starts walking back towards his light. And I looked at him and I said, that was the best, that I can't believe it. That was a great meeting. Like, wait, dad, wait, one more thing. And I was shaking my head like, dad, wait, one more thing. I wake up like this, Ian. My arms are crossed. I'm under a sheet, like up to here. And I'm shaking my head like this. And I go, open my eyes. What was that? Where am I? It's pitch black. I can't see anything. And I'm freezing all of a sudden. So I'm not wearing a hat. I go like this. First thing I do is move my right arm and touch my head. And it's ice cold. I'm like, whoa. Oh, my God. I'm freezing. I'm dead. That was heaven. I went and saw dad. I'm dead. I got to be dead. So I just blurt out, what the was that? And I scream and I go, I can talk. I can talk. And I'm literally hearing my voice and I'm almost crying. I'm so happy that I can talk. And I'm like, where the hell, what was that? And all of a sudden, out of the side, a dim light comes on, and a guy comes running in with a hazmat suit from his nose down, mm-hmm. tuft of hair, circle glasses, and black pair of Nikes, running shoes. And he goes, David, do you know where you're at? I said, no. Tell me, please. You're at Centennial Hills Hospital. My name is Gianpaolo, but my friends call me GP. You're at Centennial Hills Hospital. You had a major stroke. You had a blood clot on your brain. The doctors operated through your hip, said it went as well as it could have, and think you're going to make a full recovery. How do you feel? And I sat up a little and I went, what did you say your name was? Gianpaolo, but my friends call me GP. He said, do you mind if I call you Gianpaolo? I love the beautiful Italian name. He's like, no. I said, where are my wife and daughters? He goes, they cannot come in because of COVID. I said, can you please get them on the phone? I have to tell them I'm okay. They're out in the parking lot waiting to see if I'm going to die or not. Next thing I know, it's a whirlwind. 10 minutes, people are like, he's up. Physical therapist comes in. Move your arms. Move your legs. I'm ready to go. The speech therapist comes in. Hands me a list of words. Can you read these? Dog, cat, jump, run, move. She's like, you can talk? Yeah. Yeah. I'm ready to go. I got a softball tournament with the kids this weekend. I got to go. And they're like, hold on, you're in intensive care. You're not going anywhere. Guy walks in. I swear to God, and he looks like he's 12. He says, hi, I'm Dr. Zog. I'm the guy that operated on you. And I was like, wow, okay. I said, Doc, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but how old are you? And I'd have made the number like 23 and a half. I'm sure. He goes, 32. I said, 32. I said, well, you look great, Doc. He said, well, listen, what I saw inside of you takes people out. He said, you got here in enough time. Your sister's being home your daughter's being home from COVID probably saved your life.
Right.
He said, if they're at school, they might come home and find you dead or find you so, if you're not here, you probably never talk again. You may never move your right side again. He said, you got very lucky, my friend. You got a second chance at life. He said, God bless you and good luck. Shook my hand. I said, thanks, Doc. I never saw him again. He walked out of that room. I never saw him again. 5 days later, after a zillion tests, I get the call. Guy comes in and says, you're going home. I was like, great. Let's go. I had been waving to my daughters. They would come to the window. I got stationed at the eighth floor at Centennial Hills Hospital. They would come to the parking lot. And I would wave and talk to them on the phone because I didn't have a phone. I didn't have anything when I went in. They said, you're going home today. So I said, I called my wife. I said, send clothes. I need clothes. I've been walking around with this gown and my ass hanging out for 5 days and trying to just, you know, relax. I open up the bag after they send it. The nurse brings it up. It's my softball uniform that I've been coaching my kids that I missed the tournament. So it's game day. I didn't need no note. It's game day. I knew what they meant. I start crying. I get dressed, shave. I'm like, I'm ready to go. The two women that took care of me for 5 days, two angels, come in and say, you ready to go? I said, yeah, we're ready. All right, we got a wheelchair for you. And I'm like, listen, you guys wheeled me in here. I got to walk out of here. For me, my wife, my daughters, they got to see me walk out of here. I don't want to get you in trouble. And I mean, no disrespect, but I got to walk out. They said, Dave, we'll wheel you down the hall. You can say goodbye to everybody. When we get down the elevator, you can walk out. Deal? Deal. Say goodbye to the whole eighth floor. Amazing experience. There's people that were on that floor. It's a stroke center of Nevada. I didn't know this. It's an absolute mm-hmm. miracle that I live 7 minutes away. And there's people that are never going to talk. They're never going to walk again. I can't even explain how thankful and grateful I am. Get down the bottom. Stand up out of this wheelchair. Say goodbye to these two women. Dude, I walked out of there like Conor McGregor. I was so, I was like, oh, fuck. I did the walk. My kids mobbed me. My wife hugged me. Even my mother-in-law, who gets a pickup, whether she really likes me. She gave me a hug and a kiss and said, don't scare us like that again. I said, well, we're back. And it was at that moment we were driving away and I put the window down. And my wife said, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "The trees, the sky, the smell." She goes, "Where do you want to go eat?" I said, "It doesn't matter. I don't care. I'm just happy I'm alive." And she goes, "What are we going to do? What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't think I'm supposed to go back and work in a risk room."
Yeah.
So that's the story. Like, you know, and I've told that on multiple shows. I don't know when the book's going to come out, how I'm going to write it, what I'm going to say. People don't believe it. They can believe it if they want. I know it happened to me, and you know how I can tell it so well. After I got out of intensive care, I got into a regular room, and I had to hustle the nurse to let me get up from bed rest. I said, "I can walk." And she's like, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I'll bet you I can walk. If I can't, you can put me back on bed rest." So I got up, she unhooked me, and I did a shuttle run to the wall and back, to the wall and back. She's like, "Oh my God, you actually can." I'm like, "I'm good. I need paper and pen." She's like, "For what?" I said, "I need to write." And at the end of this hall was an observation room, basically a room full of chairs looking out over the valley. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable view from the 8th floor of Centennial's Hospital. And I had a bunch of blank paper and a pen. And all I did was write. And it literally was coming out of me. I mean, it almost felt like the pen was moving without me thinking. And I wrote this story. And I remembered the dream. And I saw my dad and all these different things. So I know it happened. And it made, like, thinking about, like, what the first half of the Hofstra Stetson game should be, like, seem inconsequential. You know what I mean? I was like, I can't. Right. How am I going to go back and do that? I don't think I can right. do it. So that's right. how I got almost not placed, but forced to go, like, figure something out. You're going to do media? Do media. And I got out of risk rooms. That was the last day. September 1st, 2020 was the last day I worked in a book, booking games.
That's an incredible story.
Unbelievable,
and
dude.
I mean, the detail in which, you know, the part about your dad, I mean, you know, you can't make that up. My only question though is how long were you under for?
3 hours.
3 hours. Okay.
3 hours. It felt like I took a nap. I came out on Tuesday. The first thing that I saw once we got the lights on, they turned the TV on. The Clippers were playing the Nuggets. And I was doing a show with Peralt, the Bostonian versus the book that it is now. He was doing a radio show out of the Palms called Pushing the Odds. And I was talking to him as his odds maker guy inside the book every Monday, Thursday, and Friday. And he had a bet in the bubble on the Nuggets against the Clippers. The game comes on, and I was like, "Oh, the game's on." And I said to GP, who was watching me, I said, "Do you watch basketball?" He's like, "No, I only like soccer." And I said, "I'm not really good with the soccer odds." I said, "I had to learn it during COVID." He said, "But this basketball game is going to be really good. The Clippers are 10-point favorites, and the Nuggets could win." He's like, "You think so?" And I said, "Yeah, let's watch." And I'm sitting there, and a sense of calm came over me that I can't explain other than us people who love watching sports and have done the booking and have made bets go, I'm watching this going, the Nuggets could win. If they win this game, that series bet that he has at 16-1 is live. My wife is calling me, you know, to make sure I'm okay. And my phone's lighting up because it's supposed to be NFL opening weekend that weekend. And she's like, what do I tell people? I said, tell them I had a stroke. Tell them I'm going to be okay and I'll be home in a couple days. I don't know what to tell them. It's first time for me too. But I said, tell Peralt that the Nuggets bet is alive because they end up winning game 5 and they come back and win that series.
Clippers blew a 3-1 lead, right?
What's that?
Clippers blew a 3-1 lead in that series, or a 3-2
lead. Exactly. Yeah. Like that's, see, but that's how we talk. Like, we remember those things because of the betting, but because of, we're sports fans first. I tell people this all the time. How do you get in this business? One, you love sports, not like sports. You have to love sports. And then you you learn the business. However you learn it, you learn the business, but you still have to love sports because this business, and you'll attest to this, beats your love of sports out of you every day and twice on Sunday. You love sports until you work in the business. And there are more people that are miserable working in this business because they got that love of sports beaten out of them. God put me in this position to love sports again. And I'm so thankful. I have immense gratitude. Dude, I wake up every day. First thing I do is look up in the sky and I breathe. The next thing I say is good morning so I can hear myself talk. After that, we're good to go. We'll figure the rest out.
You're playing with house money at that point.
That's it, baby.
That's it. All right. Well, that was incredible. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. You got to come back because there was a ton more we didn't get to, but I'm so glad you shared that story.
You got the number. You know, I've been following from a distance. I refer people to Prop Swap all the time. I've seen what you've done. We've had these sidebar conversations at these conferences. I know the struggle. Anything I can do to help you, you know, I'm a phone call away, a text away. Keep doing what you're doing. You sent me stuff the year after, so 2021. I got some prop swap gear. I got a hat, and I got a nice collared shirt. I've since moved twice. I'm in a house. I don't know where the hat is. I got to be perfectly honest, but we're gonna maybe have to ramp up the prop swap gear.
I'll send you another hat. You should have told me earlier. All right, yeah, we will do this again. I sincerely appreciate it. He is at Sportsbook Consig on Twitter. Like I said, co-host of Bostonian versus the Book.
Yep.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
You got it, Ian. Thank you, sir.
Thank you once again to Dave for coming on and sharing his story. Again, just an incredible story about his health scare and really, truly a great lesson about, you know, pursuing the thing that you want to do and not sitting back and staying in the job that you have the time. And, you know, don't worry. Everything will work out. So, again, thank you to Dave. Thank you to you for listening. Please make sure to subscribe, leave a rating, and we will talk to you next week.